Throughout the 40s, 50s, and early 60s, the American Psychiatric Association was a very conservative place, an organization run by what were described to me by a former APA president as businessmen psychiatrists, well-meaning gray-haired, 50s-style professionals. Now, when the 60s arrived, these men weren't particularly interested in weighing in on the issues of the day, on Kent State or civil rights, Vietnam. Then a relatively small group of homosexual activists started making noise about their designation in the DSM. Specifically, the activists rejected the idea that they needed to be cured of their desire. They said that they only needed the stigma of insanity to be removed from homosexuality so that they could get jobs teaching children or practicing psychiatry, basically so that they could finally achieve equal rights. Now, at the time, these protests didn't make much of an impression on the doctors of the APA. They saw themselves as scientists, and scientifically, there was near universal agreement that homosexuals were at least one donut short of a dozen. I spoke to 10 different psychiatrists who were members of the APA during the time of the redefinition, and I began each of my interviews with the same question. What percentage of the APA believed that homosexuality was pathology in 1970 when this story begins?
Oh, well over 90%.
In 1970?
Oh, I think so. Sure.
95, 98, 99. Even the ones of us who were gay.
All right, so that's a clip from This American Life, which was produced by National Public Radio a number of years ago, and I actually heard it when it first aired and have never forgotten it. And it's relevant to my discussion today with a psychologist who has now been confronting the APA about their behavior when it comes to what they're diagnosing, what they're saying, the political correctness that is killing, really, literally and figuratively, the hearts and souls of the American people. And so that's the tough discussion we're going to have, and it started, really, way back during the early 70s. And I'm going to tell you a little bit of that story more after I finish speaking with Dr. Jeffrey Hansen, who is, by the way, a clinical psychologist specializing in trauma, addiction, and adolescent mental health. And he's going to be joining us. But then after that, I want to tell you a little bit more about what happened back in 1973. But first, nearly 11% of women who have taken a chemical abortion pill in recent years have experienced a serious adverse health event, such as infection, hemorrhage, or sepsis. And that's according to a report from the Foundation for the Restoration of America. And they had a team of board-certified OBGYN clinicians comb through more than 865,000 claims related to chemical abortions between 2017 and 2023 and found that at least 10.9% resulted in a serious adverse health event. I just want you to know how serious the abortion pills, so-called pills, are to women, to your children, to your sisters and mothers and daughters. So that's why Preborn has taken on this whole challenge. They are able to give women who've been so deluded as to take this first pill, if they come to the clinic before they take the second one, they can often reverse the killing of the baby, really, is what it is. The first pill kills the baby, the second one expels. So a Preborn has taken a proactive response to this, for which I'm so grateful, because these chemical abortions are accounting for something like 70% of abortions now. It's really outrageous. And we don't hear the stories because it's politically incorrect to report it. So if you'd like to help Preborn, the other thing they do, as you all know if you listen to this show, is that they provide ultrasounds for moms who are pregnant and considering terminating their pregnancy. And once they see their baby, they almost all of them decide to keep the baby. It's pretty powerful. It's just God, you know. It's just technology and God. And so if you'd like to help, it's $28 for one ultrasound. And, of course, the other thing I mentioned, their attack against this abortion pill, the way of saving the babies and the mom, and the moms too. If you want to help, go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy, and make your most generous donation. All right. Well, this is Sandy Rios on Sandy Rios 24/7. I forgot to tell you that part. If you'd like to call us, you can call us at 662-821-2040. 662-821-2040. You can write us at sandy@afr.net. My website is sandyrios.com, and that's a good place to listen to the podcast. You can find it easily there. But we're available on any podcast platform, and especially we're available at AFR.net. AFR.net. That's our home base, American Family Radio. We are also on all social media platforms, the ones that you like, and maybe the ones that you don't like. But we're there, and you can find the podcast there also. Well, today we have a pretty fascinating discussion, and it affects really all of us. I think that our whole awareness of the use of drugs and the misleading of people, doctors, psychiatrists. I remember when doctors started under the Obama administration, they were supposed to be asked patients in their questionnaire, opening questionnaire, about what? You have gout, or you've got a sore foot or a cut. Do you have a gun in your home? And what is your religion? That's the first indication that I remember that our medical system was moving to the left. But wow, it's really moving to the left now, and that's what we're going to discuss with our guest, who's already paid a huge price for taking a stand on this very issue. So stay tuned and listen to Sandy Rios 24/7.
From American Family Radio, Sandy Rios.
We are not called to be nice. We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
I think the most important thing we need to demonstrate to our children is genuineness, that we actually believe what we say we believe.
A longtime Fox News contributor, Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
Seek justice, not social justice, but God's justice, what's right and what's wrong.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association,
a pro-life radio talk show host.
We've got to say this is the line. Life is sacred.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
On December 15, 1973, this president and this board called a press conference where they announced to the world that they had approved the deletion of homosexuality from the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistics Manual. Charles Socarides, naturally, was appalled.
I said, holy s***, they're changing the rules. If there's anything you couldn't change in this world would be the relationship between a male and a female. They go together. They go together through all of evolution, right up the animal kingdom, right to man. And now they're saying it's just as natural to mate with the same sex as it is with the opposite sex. What will psychiatry think? What will medicine think? What will pediatric think? They think we've gone insane.
The headline in our newsletter at the National Gay Task Force was, "The Earth is Round." And that's what it was to us. They finally got around to having a grain of sanity.
All right, that's a little piece from a radio program that comes from NPR called This American Life, which tells the story of how the American Psychological Association or Psychiatric Association decided that homosexuality was normal. I mean, there's a lot more ways to describe it. They took it out of the list of mental disorders. And the way the process worked was because of homosexual activists on the outside and closet gay psychologists, psychiatrists on the inside. It was a cabal, a plan, and that's how it happened. And that was in 1973, ironically, the same year that Roe v. Wade was passed. Isn't that something, that abortion was legalized? So so that brings us to today, because a lot of water has gone under the bridge. And so where is the American Psychological Association, the APA? Well, I'll just give you a little hint. The trigger for this particular interview was a title that the American Psychological Association's 2025 convention has a symposium titled "The Kink and Flourishing Study, Impact of Kink Involvement in People's Personal Growth and Healing." I want to warn you, this conversation will not be for your children. We're not going to get too graphic, but there will be discussions of things they don't need to know about. They just don't need to know about it. So this is an adult conversation, and to have that adult conversation, I want to bring to you someone who really does speak up. He's spoken up at great cost to himself about what's happening with the APA. His name is Dr. Jeffrey Hansen. He's the clinical director of Hold Fast Recovery. He's the founder and director of what is called NeuroFaith. He's based in Prescott, Arizona. He's a clinical psychologist and a whole lot more. He's practiced in the Army, He has his own personal practice. He works with children a lot, and his hot buttons are our hot buttons. And so with that, Dr. Jeff, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Sandy. It's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Okay, now I should put the color in. I know you love motorcycles, and your bio is delightful. It's just a lot of fun. You live in Seattle, right? Seattle, Washington?
Well, I used to live in the Seattle area. We're now down in Arizona.
Oh, that's right.
We fled Washington State. I say I'm a refugee from Washington State, now living in Arizona.
Okay,
so,
all right.
Our new life is in Arizona. We feel just very happy here.
Can we go back? I know this is a tough, maybe we could do a touch on a very, very tough topic for you. But I was reading your bio, and you are actually, your heritage is European, Austrian, I believe, German, kind of a mix. And you had an identical twin brother, but you had kind of a troubled home or a troubled father. Can you explain that? And I'm guessing, because this might be the root of why you went into psychology.
Well, perhaps so. We sometimes are masters of our, we try to master our history, but in my case, in my brother's case, my twin brother's case, we, and an older brother as well, we grew up in a family of, my dad was a professional, very hard driving, but suffered a lot of trauma by the hands of his own father. And sadly, as things go, they were visited, that trauma was visited on my brothers and myself, and so we both suffered from that, or all three of us suffered from that. And my brother in particular, my twin brother, was, I believe, the most vulnerable. And he suffered a fair amount of depression from that. And the way my brother and I tried to circumvent that was to achieve. And when you achieve, you feel better, you can kind of push it down. There's a model therapy called IFS, which explains that beautifully. But in the end, Greg's depression overtook him, and he succumbed to that, and basically gave up on life. And so, as he died about a year and a half ago, I purposed to use his passing and his life and his struggles to really catalyze my desire to help others, even in a deeper way, and to be very authentic and open about that struggle.
Yeah. And you're putting it very succinctly, but I can only imagine. My dad was a twin. The loss of an identical twin, and one of my best friends has identical twin boys, and they grew up with my boy. And so it's just kind of hard to describe. You should do a study on twins sometimes in your spare time, Jeff. But this, as I understand it, because you and I talked privately, promoted you to sort of do something very, very bold, because the practice of psychology and psychiatry has really become corrupted. You call it, I think, so you say it's broken. And when did you really realize that psychology that you were practicing was broken? Did you know it from the beginning?
I did not know that from the beginning. And I think from the first 20 years or so, I was fine with my practice. And then, really, it's actually been, to be fair, really more the last 10 to 15 years where I realized there's just something wrong. And what I've come to appreciate is that that psychology and mental health in general has been ideologically captured. When I wrote a book on transgender issues, transgender confusion amidst the search of identity, I did a deep dive into neo-Marxism. It sounds kind of conspiracy theory-ish. But the issues of what Marx and Engels did, and then followed by Gramsci, who decided that we needed to take in all the culture, or at least Marxism as a political, as a economic form, didn't work. And so they went through really all the institutions, as Gramsci talks about, the march to the institutions. Actually, that was merely more Rudy. And because the economic aspect didn't work, they went through all the institutions. That includes political, academic, and certainly mental health as well. And so we see in practice of psychology and mental health in general is there's a push to really capture our youth at a young age. Queer theory does that shockingly well. When you destabilize children, you criticize anything that's heteronormative, and anything that's apparent is the new norm. And so by destabilizing children with that, then they can capture them. And so I, as I was looking at the whole transgender issue, I came to appreciate that that was really just a ploy. These children were pawns in that push to capture our children, capture our society, and then they can mold it in the way they want. So
yeah,
I wrote about that openly, and then I saw that happening just in mental health in general.
Yeah. Well, this is not shocking to me because, you know, the communist teaching really on sexuality is like, I remember the Weather Underground were that early 80s radical group in this country who practiced smash monogamy. They wouldn't have private sex with anyone. They'd always just have it as a group. And that goes back to the communist just doctrine of complete anarchy. I call it sexual anarchy. So, and the... We can see that the radical left uses psychology all the time, Jeff. This is not a shock. And
absolutely.
I remember when Barack Obama ran for president, they had hundreds of psychologists working with his campaign. So all of that is just what you just said is just borne out in what has actually happened. So what you wrote this open letter to, it's called An Open Letter to My Psychology and Psychiatry Colleagues. A call to restore integrity in mental health care. And you really, I read this letter and I was so impressed, Jeff, because it is hard hitting, but it's just true. Let me read a couple of your words, if you don't mind. For psychiatry, the pivot from patient-centered care to pharmacological dogma is undeniable. We sold the public the chemical imbalance myth, a theory that has been thoroughly debunked. We did so while knowing the research never conclusively supported it. What we are doing to our patients when we tell them that their suffering is the result of a broken brain, a chemical imbalance, what message does this send to children and adolescents whose developing minds are particularly vulnerable to such narratives? We are creating a generation of passive recipients of psychiatric labels rather than empowering individuals to confront, process, and heal from their pain. All right, can put some flesh on what you said in this letter, and then let's talk about what happened afterwards.
Well, actually, that was a letter I believe I wrote to Johnson, Jeff Johnson, who wrote as a member of Focus on the Family against the whole issue of what was happening with kinky sex. I wrote a separate letter before that to the members of CMDA, Christian Medical and Dental Association, specifically calling out so that was a different list, specifically calling out psychiatry and prescribing, and that was heavily criticized. It was that second letter that caused me some trouble with CMDA, an organization that I belong to and love, and was hoping to just open up a dialogue with prescribers about the misuse of overuse of psychotropic medications. And I'm not a prescriber, I admit it, but I do have a PhD. And my PhD is a clinical psychologist. It's a research degree and also a clinical degree, but it does give me competence in looking at research. And that letter, that one, stirred up a whole lot of discussion, a heated discussion. And at first, leadership at CMDA loved the letter. And then later it caused so much consternation that psychiatry was demanding that it got taken down, and it did. So I was deplatformed in that sense with CMDA. And although I love CMDA, I was very disappointed with leadership for making that decision.
The Jeff, I should...
referencing.
Just let me explain. It's that you're speaking of the Christian Medical and Dental Association, CMDA.
Exactly.
That's what those letters represent. Right. People need to, okay, so go ahead, please.
And it's a wonderful organization. They equip physicians and healers to in a Christian way do the work of Christ, and they do that very well. It's a beautiful organization, and the problem is that the left has censored free speech,
And I love the Second Amendment, but I love the First Amendment more, freedom of speech. And freedom of speech is something we're losing in medicine and losing in mental health. And we're pushed to speak on certain narratives in a certain way, whether it's transgender or whatever, critical race, all these things. And so CMDA, who I do believe does stand for free speech, the leadership caved when psychiatry, who is a discipline, psychiatry is a discipline that is struggling for identity, for purpose, and they very much want to be seen as frontline physicians who do real medicine, but psychiatry, it's a soft science, if you will. And I think that my calling out medicine and looking at the outcome studies that psychotropics, when used judiciously and carefully, can save lives. I'm not against medication. I'm against overuse of medication, over-medicalizing children, and giving them a false narrative that they have a specific disease. And I'm not saying you can't have a disease of the brain. You can. But most cases of suffering, most cases of mental struggle and emotional struggle in children and adults, it's not a function of a disease. It's a function of problems of living, trauma, and other things. And so this narrative that you have a disease that must be medicalized is overdone. And that was what got me in trouble with CMDA leadership. And that's why they took my letter down, my blog down.
Well, there's so many things that you confronted here. I'm glad you explained that. And I don't understand. Yes, I do, Jeff. I do understand, because there are people, I suppose, that just annoy people because they speak the truth. Mm-hmm. And you're one of those people. Yeah. You're speaking the truth. This letter is powerful. I think I have the right letter here. It's
we have a letter. There's two letters. There's one I did to CMDA, Sandy, and then there's the other letter. I just, if I have it right, the letter I wrote, because I just loved Jeff Johnson of Focus on the Family's general letter that he put out, and I forgot where he published it, but I read it and was so moved by it, I just had to write him a letter. So it captured a lot of just my ranty feelings about all of this.
Well, he published it in the Daily Citizen at Focus on the Family.
There you go.
But I actually not. I was reading mm-hmm. from your open letter to psychology and mm-hmm. psychiatry colleagues. So I didn't know.
It may have been a separate. I mean, I have to say, I rant a lot because this stuff just so stirs in me. So sometimes I'll get moved and I'll just write something and put it on my little blog and my website.
Well, you know what? So. That's why we're talking. Because you have courage, mm-hmm. and because you are like probably, I'm sure you're not the only voice, but I'm sure it's pretty lonely, especially when the Christian Medical and Dental Association asks you to take this down. But listen, I've been down this highway in other ways myself. And I'm just mm-hmm. encouraging you, Jeff, just steadfast, steady as she goes, steady. Don't ever back off. Don't back off. Because you're doing a tremendous service. For every person that's criticizing you, don't you know there are I'll say tens of hundreds, I don't know, thousands maybe in the field working who were probably just said, finally, someone has spoken the truth. But let's go into this a little bit more for lay people, because what are your complaints? What are your concerns, not complaints? I wouldn't want to reduce it to that. These are legitimate concerns about psychiatry and psychology right now. What are they?
Well, it's not, again, it's not just medicine. It's not just overuse of medication. It's much broader than that. It's that we have caved in to the pressures of the progressive left, which I believe are just minions of the whole neo-Marxist, without even being aware of it. They are. They're captured by that. And mental health, which tends to be a somewhat general leaning to the left field anyway, just completely lost their way. And so they push narratives. For example, let me go back a little bit. When you come in for treatment, there's a thing called informed consent. And you should be able to go, well, Dr. Smerdlitz, I would like to cover yada, yada, yada. And Dr. Smerdlitz will say, yes, I'm skilled in that. I can do that treatment. If I'm not, then I'll refer you on. So let's say you come in with depression. Well, Dr. Smerdlitz may determine that, you're depressed because you're a white male, right? And they may feel that what you really need is to understand your place of privilege, your guilt, et cetera, and get in touch with that. And in so doing, then you'll be more aligned to overcome your depression. And I'm not saying that it's that pronounced always, but it's there. And the American Psychological Association pushes us to be sort of warriors of social justice. In fact, I went to a graduation, one of my students, I was on their doctoral committee, so I went to her, this was about 6 years ago, 5 years ago, and the president of Antioch gave a speech to the students, the graduating students, that we were to be critical race ideologue warriors, right, to push these agendas. There was no mention about clinical excellence, no mention at all in that speech, and I was just appalled. I'm surprised I was able to even sit through the whole thing, but I was appalled at what this person said. And having taught them, many students, many doctoral students, in training programs at my hospital, they're just all captured. And so this alarming capture of what the therapist is supposed to do rather than what they really should do, which is to honor informed consent. For example, if I come in to a provider, that provider should listen to my concerns and should not be pushing critical race. And if they're going to push critical race, they should say, listen, I'm a social justice warrior. That's going to be part of our treatment plan. So that's a violation to me of informed consent. It's an ethical violation. Yet, as providers, we're pushed to do that. Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing.
And even at any, yeah, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I think we have a delay. I think it is amazing. It's horrific, really. And it makes me wonder, Jeff, how it is possible. And I'll ask you, how mm-hmm. is it possible for a serious follower of Christ to exist in that atmosphere? Because there's punishment now if you cross the lines.
It is very difficult. It is very hard to be. And you use the term lonely. I have to say, Sandy, it is lonely. And I've thought about how many of my colleagues that I've trained with or spent time with are willing to speak out. And among the colleagues that I know, you want to know the answer?
Yeah.
Yes. I can't think of one colleague that's speaking out with me. And the ones that agree with me are afraid to speak out. And, for example, in the whole transgender movement, there are others that believe as I did, that the medicalization of children without their informed consent and knowing that it caused all kinds of harm, were afraid to say anything. And I did, and I wrote a book on it when I was actually at my hospital, Madigan. And upon my departure, around the time I was leaving my last several months there, as I was moving towards retirement from the Department of Defense, someone levied charges against me that was defrauding the government. And I believe that person, I'm not going to mention that person here, of course, but I believe that person who knowingly had issue with me and my stance while I was at Madigan for my conservative views made allegations against me. And it took some time to get cleared up. I'm fine. I've left and in good standing. But what a terrible thing to have to go through. And then later then was making threats to go after my license, have a Washington license. And then also I was interviewed by a progressive transgender person who wanted to interview me on my stance on pornography. I believe that pornography is bad for children. I believe it's one of the vectors towards transgenderism. And that's absolutely true. It's a small vector, but it's a vector. She criticized me of being in violation of the of clinical therapy ban, conversion therapy ban laws, because if that is pornography is a vector for transgenderism, and I'm speaking against pornography, therefore I'm precluding these children who would be liberated by being transgender I'm thwarting that, and therefore my license should be surrendered. She called for my license. So these are the kinds of things that happen if you speak out.
Yes.
You're punished. You're censored.
Jeff,
and I live in fear in that, but I believe that we should not submit to fear.
Yes. Well, that is certainly the goal. Perfect love casts out fear, and that means the love of God, trusting Him. But it's when you're in the thick of it, it's your livelihood, it's your reputation. By the way, Jeff has written so many books: Neurofaith, the Intersection of Science and Faith, and the Healing of Trauma and Addiction. Adolescent Depression, a Neurofaith Model for Healing Mind, Body, and Soul, The Storm and the Pathway to Peace, and Digital Enslavement. And he's a very prolific writer, and I've read lots of his stuff from his website, which I should give. His personal website is jeffreyhansenphd.com. Jeffrey Hansen, and that's HANSENPHD.com. His official website for his ministry, or his, not his ministry's practice, holdfastrecovery.com, holdfastrecovery.com. But Jeff, you and I spoke offline a couple of days ago about what happened to the APA back in 1973. And I told you, without going into great detail here, I had some intersection with this, with Dr. Robert Spitzer, who was one of the key figures in that whole drama. But what I want to do right now, this story was told by public radio on what's called This American Life, and I heard this in the early 2000s when it first ran, and I've never forgotten it. And I looked it up before you and I talked this morning, and I just want to share just a couple of clips. This is the granddaughter of, what's his name? It's one of the doctors. I'll find it. But she's telling the story, and she does a very accurate and compelling job. And she tells the story of Dr. Irving Beaver and Dr. Charles Zacharitis, who were opposing this whole change. This was a move by the homosexual activists and the whole big bunch of homosexual therapists who were closeted psychiatrists. And so as things progressed and their strength became greater to remove homosexuality from this diagnostic manual as some sort of a mental illness, this is what happened. I think you'll relate to this. This is clip 5. Let's listen.
This turn of events was naturally distressing to the opponents of the change, Irving Bieber and his friend, Dr. Charles Zacharitis.
I know I talked to the outgoing president at the time. He shook his head. He said, I don't know what's going to happen now. They got gays galore. They're running for office. One of them may be president.
Suddenly, Bieber and Zacharitis found themselves in a position that just 2 years before they could not have conjured in their most outlandish nightmares. They were becoming professional renegades, and the work that had established their reputations was under fire. Again, Charles Zacharitis.
Papers that we wanted to give at various places was suddenly said, well, we don't think that would be a good thing to do right now in the current environment and the atmosphere.
It wasn't just professional rejection. Personally, Bieber and Zacharitis had become targets. Angry gay activists followed them around, protesting every paper. There were threatening phone calls late at night and obscene messages scratched into the paint of department bathroom stalls.
All kinds of things, that you're killing the gay man, that you're persecuting us, you ought to be dead. I mean, things like that, all kinds of death threats. I went to Kansas City one day, Topeka. One of my friends said, I have a gift for you. And so he gave me a package. It was a gun. He says, Charles, he says, you're really going to have to defend yourself. Of course, I never used it. But you felt like carrying it around as people followed you to a meeting and raising terrible threat calls.
All right, we'll interrupt it right now. It goes a little bit longer than that, but I thought you would find that interesting, Jeffrey. These are the guys that opposed it. It came down to two, and they were hounded and fought and threatened, their lives threatened. And these are psychiatrists.
It's amazing.
Yeah, so some things never change, right?
Yeah, as I say, nothing new is under the sun. If you stand for principle, when there's an agenda to move it a certain way, you get hurt.
Yeah, you do. And the death of your brother, which happened, has it been over a year now? It's still fresh.
It's been about a year and a half. It's still fresh. I mean, I knew that my brother was in trouble, so I actually sadly, told my wife about a year before. I said, I'm going to lose my brother. And she said, well, how do you know, Jeff? And I said, well, because he's my twin brother. We're identical twins. And I just feel it. I just know it. And then secondly, it's what I do. I work in trauma and tough cases. And so when someone is in kind of that, I call it kind of a death spiral, you just instinctively know it. I mean, you still hold hope. But we lost him.
And was part of this the mismanagement of drugs? Did you tell me that? The overdosing, over-medicating?
I did, and I wrote on it. Greg and I both suffered similar trauma. And by the way, one little caveat, I mentioned my father earlier. My father, who was abused by his own father, both found Christ and both reconciled.
Oh.
And really, you could see the blessing of Jesus, who can heal trauma better than anything. It's one of the aspects, the best transformational therapy there is Jesus Christ. And so, I don't want people to get the wrong impression of my father. He was a good man. He was a troubled man. And so, but yes, getting back to my brother, he had trauma wounds as I did. I hit a really low point in my life when many things sort of came together and took me into a profound depression. And I was medicalized by well-meaning, I would say well-meaning psychiatrists and prescribers, and medication initially helped me. But then when I was asking my prescribers, I think this benzo or whatever I was on is too much, I think I should come off, they encouraged me not to and to continue. And I suffered a medication injury with benzodiazepines that almost took me, and thank God I was able to get off all psychotropics. I'm fine now. So, again, to be fair on psychotropics, helped me at first, but you must have a tapering plan in most cases. There are rare cases such as bipolar disease where you may need to be on medication for life. It's a very different thing. That is a very clear medical disease. Bipolar, very strongly heritable. But most cases, such as my brother and myself, it's not. So medication can initially help. My brother was medicalized, did stay on psychotropics for most of his adult life. And as things were crumbling for him, and I was following his medication course, I talked to some of his prescribers. And they were throwing throwing spaghetti on the wall, just hoping something would stick. And you saw him then more and more medications, going to antipsychotics as a secondary medication when the primary antidepressant doesn't work well. And you could see the degradation. So I'm not at all saying, to be very fair to prescribers, his prescribers, that the medications killed him, but I do think they were apart. They did not help him in the end. And what I didn't hear is his prescribers pushing or encouraging him, rather, to seek trauma-informed care. I did not hear that. And it's when we don't dig deep enough, when we don't look at what other things are going on in his life, and I won't get into all those other things here, but there were many other things, and they were not addressed. So in his case, and almost in my case, the over-medicalization of what was really going on was problematic, and not having an exit or a tapering strategy to let the brain heal, ultimately, were all things that ended up causing him, I think, harm.
Yeah.
And my struggle with psychiatry is that sometimes I feel they do more harm than good if we over-rely on medications.
Well, what else do they do? I mean, when I think of this, I think we've become, as a country, more sensitive and suspicious of medications. I'll put myself in that camp,
yeah.
That's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, mm-hmm. when you think of all the drugs now given to children, the hormonal drugs, I'm sure that's, first of all, I meant to make the point that I'm assuming that this trauma of losing your brother in this way and your own experiences is what's caused you to just finally speak out and be bold. And I applaud you for that, Jeff. I really do. And so, But now, but you're saving people's lives in another way, even if you're not seeing it now. Because one of the things you tackle is this whole business of giving drugs to children for changing their genders. Those are the kinds of things you're fighting, right?
Absolutely, and you know, over medicalizing children for having gender dysphoria is just the wrong way to go. We need to take our time. We need to explore the things that are driving that current in their lives. We need to look at trauma. We need to look at also giving children way too much sexual information early on, which confuses them. We need to look at the neo-Marxist queer theory influence that is early on, pornography in school, libraries, etc., and drag queen shows, etc. All these things stabilize kids. All this information too early causes them to question beyond that which they would normally question, and there's an obsession with gender. It didn't used to be that way. I've been doing this for 40 years, and so this new wave that's been around for the last 10-plus years is a crazy turn that's taken place. And kids, many years ago, for example, they wanted to be gangsters. It was back in the 80s, wanted to be gangsters. And that came and went. So there's this new fad then of this gender obsession, which destabilizes kids. And then they're all too quick. When we're told we must affirm, this is the ideological capture aspect of it, we must confirm there's no other path. And so rather than just doing a wait and see, if you do a wait and see approach or an explorative, let's just look at the other issues, most of these kids will desist. If you early affirm them, most all the ones that are early affirmed, yes, you're gender dysphoric, you're a trans, you need to then think about transitioning, etc. They will go through with it. They will go through with puberty blockers, with hormone, as my good colleague, Dr. Mike Laidlaw, says, wrong sex hormones, and they are. We then set them up for all kinds of horrific risks in terms of thrombosis, in terms of stroke, in terms of cancer. And we don't properly inform them. That's a whole issue of informed consent. But if you just leave them alone, most of them will work through it just fine. They may end up being gay, but they will not transition. And the medical risks of being on wrong sex hormones for your life are very problematic. They're not safe. No. They're dangerous.
Jeff, this reminds me of another story. I'm sorry. I have too many stories myself. But this was something that you may have heard of, but if you haven't, this will be interesting to you. There was a documentary, believe it or not, on PBS before you couldn't talk about homosexuality or transgenderism or whatever. And it was a Canadian psychiatrist he had a patient who had twin boys. They were born and there was an accident in the birthing room. They accidentally cut off the penis of one of the boys.
Mm-hmm.
So they took this psychiatrist, I don't know, somehow interjected himself and suggested to the parents that the way to cope with this was to give this child who'd lost his maleness female hormones and to turn him into a girl because it didn't really matter. And this child became a girl. Well, they declared him a girl even from infancy. And so the mother dressed him in girl's clothes, that he had all of these hormones. He had regular visits with this doctor. I mean, up and through his whole until his adult life. But he never adjusted, Jeff, even though he never knew anything else except being a girl. He never adjusted. He didn't fit in. He knew that something wasn't right. And he ended up getting married, and then he ended up actually taking his own life. It's quite a story. And it actually proves a lot of the arguments on transgenderism right now, that it is not, you know, the parts don't matter. It's something intrinsic, that maleness, and that these drugs are doing such tremendous harm that is really, in many cases, irreparable. What, in your practice, who is it? What kinds of people do you see?
In my previous practice, And I still have that practice in a small way. And then also, in addition, my practice when I was at Madigan, I saw many transgender children, many gender-confused children. And you're referring to John Money's case, you know, who transitioned the Ramirez twin, and he ended up taking his life. His other brother ended up taking his life as well. Tragic. But what I did at Madigan was what I wasn't supposed to do. I was supposed to transition them, actually encourage them to transition, and I would do, in every case, a wait and see, and explorative approach. And I found that when we could look at the other competing issues, such as trauma, et cetera, that they desisted and they ended up working through their problems. One case, actually prior to even being at Madigan, was a young lady, very, very impressive young lady, who at the age of 15 came to my practice and was struggling with, she was a Christian, she did not want to transition, but she had immense gender dysphoria. So not even being immersed in the literature at that point, I knew my instincts were to just not push it, work through issues. So we worked together for about 4 years on and off. And she came to appreciate that the reason why she wanted to or had this gender dysphoric issue was that her mother was incredibly anxious to the point of just not even being able to function almost. And she couldn't identify with her mother. She identified with her father, who was much safer, more stable. And years later, a letter came to me. It was actually two letters. And one was an expression of appreciation for the therapy that we did and how it helped her come to appreciate those issues. And the second letter, as I opened it up, the picture fell out. It was a picture of her and her soon-to-be husband. She now has two children, happily married, and very thankful that we didn't push any transition. So when you do that kind of therapy, you restore lives. And now there are two beautiful children on this planet because of it.
Wow. That's a great story, Jeff. That's a great thing to to be able to tell us. You know, there's been a change in a lot of things. We're just seeing the beginnings of change in our medicine. I think medicine in general has become a disaster. It's just, we could talk and talk about that. But the whole use of drugs is something that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is really bold about, and now he's the HHS secretary. Does that give you reason to hope that this whole thing might be attacked and turned around?
Oh, I have tremendous hope, and I know he's taken a lot of criticism. A lot of people don't like him. I adore him, and he's willing to say the things that many of us are thinking. And I've had the privilege of being able to communicate with Mr. Guernsey, who is one of his, he's called a counselor. He's not really a lawyer, but he's an advisor. And we've been able to share some of our writings, et cetera. And they take that in graciously. I don't hope to meet Robert Kennedy one day, but that's probably unlikely. But if I can have some small influence, that's great. But I do feel that they're doing a tremendous work. And this does need to be exposed. And, of course, he's very critical of the medicalization of children and to over-prescribing of psychotropics.
He is. I know. That's why I thought that might be just like a shot in the arm for you. And I'm so glad that you have some contact with him through one of his advisors. I think that's brilliant. Because honestly, Jeff, think about what you just said earlier. How many in your profession are willing to speak up about this? And if no one speaks up about it,
sadly, no one. I mean, I have my colleagues will say, Jeff, are you afraid you're going to get hurt? Even some of my clergy friends are saying, you know, be careful. And I just, okay, if I'm not going to speak, if you're not going to speak, who is? And then one time I was advised here recently about my letter to CNBA is, why don't you wait and see until there's more of an appetite to discuss this, until Robert Kennedy has more out there, et cetera, more momentum, if you will. And I thought about that, and I go, no, I'm not going to wait. I can't wait. You got to jump in. So maybe somebody has to jump in first.
That's right, and he needs you. If he's going to do this, he needs help in the community, professionals that are doing mm-hmm. this work. So I think it's brilliant. I think it's a great thing to do. And the thing that makes me sad, Jeff, is just to hear you say what I know is true, that the church, and I'm talking about the body of Christ, whatever profession that they're in, whatever we're doing, is just so the opposite of bold. And that's why I say this at this mic often. The church is so weak because it has no courage. It's not bold. It's not willing to speak out. And this is just another mm-hmm. illustration of that. The cautiousness, I mean, that's like, I mean, really, that is, and the antithesis of what Jesus requires of his followers. It's mm-hmm. faithful mm-hmm. unto death. It's truth speaking until death, you know? And so, mm-hmm. Jeff, I just thank you. I really do. Is there anything else that you want to add about your work or anything else that we... Sometime I'd like to talk to you again about some of these particular things that mm-hmm. you're working mm-hmm. on. But is there anything about this general discussion about the sickness that's happening in psychiatry and psychology and part of our discussion? Anything else?
Well, as pessimistic as we can be, I choose not to be pessimistic. I'm optimistic because I think the tide is turning with President Trump now in, and I know he's controversial. I know he says things that maybe he shouldn't say, but the general flavor of what he's doing, and certainly with RFK, I believe there's just tremendous hope, and the dialogue is beginning to happen. The whole transgender movement is falling apart. I'm able to have the opportunity of a team of very brave individuals: Andre Van Mol, Mike Laidlaw, Laura Haynes, Quentin Van Meter, Michelle Cortella. Just brave warriors for truth are speaking out, and somehow I've managed to be in their fold. These are giants, and they're speaking out boldly on the whole issue of transgender craziness in children, and I think they are responsible. Alliance Defending Freedom as well are all brave warriors, and so there are people that are coming out and speaking boldly, and so I'm optimistic that we're going to turn this thing around, but what I would encourage those who are standing on the sidelines that are afraid, don't let fear capture you. At the end of the day, and I'm older, I'm a 70, you start looking in the mirror. You start going, what have I stood for? Did I stand tall? Did I cower in the face of adversity? And it feels real good to know that you didn't. And so I would encourage those who are on the sidelines, please jump in. Please join us. Yes, you're going to get some arrows. Yes, you're going to get criticism. Yes, you're going to get some threats. But at the end of the day, when you hold on to your professional integrity, it feels really good.
Oh, I'm glad I asked you that last question. Oh, Jeff, I'm optimistic too, and it's really great to link up with you. So let me just tell people that your websites are holdfastrecovery.com, holdfastrecovery.com. His personal is jeffreyhansonphd.com. And by the way, on that website, he has what he calls the ranty blog, where he lays it all out about his about everything, about his, you know, takes the gloves off. It's good stuff. JeffreyHansonPhD.com. And of course, at HoldFastRecovery.com, you can get help for yourself or your loved ones. He's in Tucson, but I'm sure he can refer you maybe to that other person who's willing to speak up, that one other person.
We're actually in Prescott, to be more accurate. And so, okay. Never really been to Tucson yet. I need to go down and visit. But we're in Prescott, Arizona. And we don't say Prescott. We say Prescott. And Whole Fast Recovery, I have the honor of serving as clinical director. Brendan McDonough, Tim Hayden, and Jason White are the owners of that. Brave souls who have sought to put up an addiction trauma recovery program. We're now opening up Anchor Point soon, full residential for trauma and addiction. So... but it's very neuroscience oriented, but very, more importantly, Christian based.
Oh, that's great. That is just great news. That's just great. Jeff, we appreciate so much your time. It's Dr. Jeff Hansen, And you just heard. Mm-hmm. You heard from him. You know who he is. And I think he's a great resource for this country. And I have a feeling he may be a catalyst to see that things really do get changed. So, Jeff, thanks a lot. This is Sandy Rios on Sandy Rios 24/7. Hi, this is Sandy Rios. A lot of Christians would be shocked to learn they are personally profiting from abortion and pornography. It's unnerving to realize just how many companies and corporations are actively involved in unbiblical practices. To help cut through the red tape, there is a great option known as Timothy Plan. Timothy Plan is the pioneer in biblically responsible investing. Timothy Plan carefully filters out companies involved in practices Scripture tells us to avoid. We are in an all-out culture war. One powerful way to make a difference is to put our money where our values are. Please go to timothyplan.com/Sandy. That's timothyplan.com/Sandy. Or call 1-800-TIM-PLAN. That's 1-800-846-7526. Discover how to be a biblically responsible investor.
Before investing, carefully consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the investment company. This and other important information can be found in the fund's prospectus. To obtain a copy, visit timothyplan.com or call 800-846-7526. Read each prospectus carefully before investing.
This is Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
And the FDA finally approved the French abortion pill. And again, there was two pills. They okayed the first one, mifepristone, for chemical abortions up to 7 weeks. Later, that was extended to 10 weeks under Barack Obama. And then under Joe Biden, they opened the door to the FDA approving of mifepristone prescriptions online, through the mail, and without any kind of supervision. And the Supreme Court upheld that unanimous ruling just in 2024. It really is despicable. I'm telling you, it is despicable, given the number of injuries, 10% or so of women who have these chemical abortions, not to mention the loss of life, the trauma of delivering at home. It is a disgraceful thing that our country has done. But Preborn is trying to provide a redemptive way to stop it. They have a pill that can actually reverse that first pill, and the first one is mifepristone. So if a mother has second thoughts when she takes that first pill, if she gets to a preborn clinic, they can stop that. But if she takes the second pill, which expels the baby, it's too late. And that's why we're trying to educate women, not educate. I hate that. Just really too sterile. We're trying to move their hearts by showing them their baby in utero through ultrasound. That's what preborn does. That's the emotional trigger, which is genuine and real from the heart of God. That's a baby. And when women see that, they don't take these abortion pills. It stops it before it begins. But both things have to be addressed, and that's what preborn does. If you would like to help, it's $28 for one ultrasound. Just go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy. And please make your most generous donation.
The Sandy Rios 24/7 podcast are available at AFR.net. Back to Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
This is the story of a definition. Three single sentences composed of 81 words. It's the story of how this particular definition became another definition. Nine sentences composed of 237 words. Now, according to some parties, this change, from 81 words to 237 words, liberated an entire category of humanity. According to other parties, it undermined the basic family unit, compromised the scientific authority of psychiatry, and, quote, tampered with the basic code and concept of life.
That's the beginning of the video produced by NPR a number of years ago called This American Life. And it's the story of how the American Psychiatric or Psychological Association did get rid of homosexuality as a declassified it, and it was no longer a mental illness. The reason the production by This American Life gripped me so much was that when I was on radio in Chicago, I, by a fluke, ended up, it was an intentional fluke, talking to Dr. Robert Spitzer. Dr. Robert Spitzer was a central player in removing homosexuality from that diagnostic manual as a mental illness. And so when I was there on radio, the news had broken that Dr. Spitzer had changed his mind. After all those years, probably 20, he had changed his mind. He actually met with a bunch of ex-gays through Exodus International. He'd spent some time with them, and he was convinced that you could change. You could change. And he came out publicly saying that. Well, guess what happened to Dr. Spitzer? He had his, came under such vicious attack, you would not believe it. And so when he spoke to me, he was a little shy. And the interesting thing about it is he was an atheist. And I didn't explain to him that I was a Christian. It wasn't important. I interview all kinds of people. But I remember him telling me about his meeting with the ex-gays, how he felt about it. And then he heard one of my commercials, which was a Christian commercial, and he got really wonky on me. So that was my experience with that. But later, when I went to Washington, D.C., I heard this production of This American Life, which was from the granddaughter of one of the leaders of the movement to remove that homosexuality from the diagnostic manual. And so I was just spellbound, and I think it's important to our history, and certainly for NPR, who is, you know, public radio, I mean, public radio is so populated by gay people, transgender people. They're just all about that. And so this, for their part, was very important to get right. So it was a benefit to me to hear what they had to say. So the person telling the story is the daughter of one of the main players. Her name is Alex Spiegel. And so she tells the story about how her grandfather, Dr. John Spiegel, was a little strange, and how they used to go and spend summers with him and some of the odd things that he would do. But that's part of the story. But then she tells this story. He was, again, the president eventual, another president of the APA. But this is the part that no one knew. This is clip two.
I remember it well. Remember the plane and the drive from the airport and arriving and discovering that the hotel had a swimming pool installed about 50 feet away from the beach. I remember thinking that a pool so close to the water was both ridiculously decadent and somehow incredibly exciting. I also remember my grandfather stepping out of his beachfront bungalow on that first day, followed by a small, well-built man, a man that later, during dinner, my grandfather introduced to his shocked family as his lover, David. David was the first of a long line of very young men that my grandfather took up with after my grandmother's death. It turned out that my grandfather had had gay lovers throughout his life, had even told his wife-to-be that he was homosexual 2 weeks before their wedding.
All right, so remember, this is the future president of the, at that time, of the APA, and that's the group that eventually took homosexuality out of the list of mental illnesses. And so these closeted homosexual psychiatrists and psychologists called themselves the Gay PA, the Gay PA, and they began to work to overturn this secretly, clandestinely. Meanwhile, the activists in San Francisco, gay activists, got very involved from the outside. They marched into meetings dressed flamboyantly. They disrupted. They threatened. They intimidated. And so it resulted in the mental disorder known as homosexuality being removed from that class. Now, they felt great victory, and so that This American Life is celebrating that. We don't celebrate it so much, but I do think it's worth hearing what Alex, how she describes what's happening today, and I want you to listen. This is clip 7.
Today, there's no entry in the DSM on homosexuality. No entry at all. In 1987, the 237 words that Robert Spitzer wrote about ego-dystonic homosexuality were quietly removed. Meanwhile, the APA turned itself upside down. In 1970, 90% of the American Psychiatric Association believed that homosexuality was a pathology. Today, 90% believe that it's a normal variant of sexual behavior, no more pathological than something like left-handedness. In fact, it's now considered unethical to treat homosexuality, and any psychiatrist who attempts to change the sexual orientation of his patient can face professional censure. If a gay person finds his sexual preference disturbing, if he's interested in becoming heterosexual, and there are many people who fit this description, the APA guidelines suggest that the therapist counsel his patient that change is impossible.
All right, so the National Public Radio thinks that's a great victory, but you can see now the seeds of what's happening now with the AP were planted. And I started this show by telling you that the APA 2025 is hosting a symposium entitled The Kink and Flourishing Study, Impact of Kink Involvement in People's Personal Growth and Healing. I'm not going to go into what kink is. It's just, you can imagine, it's perverse. It's a punishing. It's leather. It's all of these horrible things that we don't even need to be thinking about, but you need to understand what it is. And so this is from an article written by Jeff Johnston of Focus on the Family, describing what's going on at the APA. He says that the group, this particular group at within the APA, considers kinky folk or a sexual minority, akin to those who identify as homosexual or a transgender. Sound familiar? With the concomitant belief that the condition is lifelong, has an early onset, is unlikely to change, and may have a biological component. They believe the group is unjustly stigmatized by society. You see how this goes. It started back in the 1970s where they decided that homosexuality was normal because they were populated by homosexual psychiatrists, and the ones that weren't were threatened, terribly threatened, as we played a clip earlier for you to listen to. And they succeeded in removing it. And now here we are saying they've got this whole session on kink and how it's restorative. Kink is good for you. It's the upside down. It's wicked and evil, but that's what's happening. And that's why I think that our guest was right, Jeff is right, that the coming onto the scene of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is just a wonderful thing, and we need to pray for him. I don't know where he is spiritually. I understand he's been a little more tenderized, but we don't know. But he certainly has the right belief about this, and so we need to pray that President Trump stays strong because he approves of the work that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is doing. And if he should prevail, then people like Jeff, may their kind flourish. It will flourish, and that's what we pray for the sake of our kids and our future. Well, I want to thank our sponsor, of course, Timothy Flynn, because we couldn't do what we do without their help. They show you how to put your money where your values are and discover how to be a biblically responsible investor. Visit timothyplan.com/Sandy. That's timothyplan.com/Sandy. Or call 1-800-TIM-PLAN. That's 1-800-TIM-PLAN. Well, thank you for listening to today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.